Good morning, church. Alex, I don't know where you're sitting, but big thanks to you for leading our thoughts this morning. You are right in front of me. Thank you for what you shared. You started with something going on in your own life, and then you connected it to all of us. We've all got something going on, and then you took that and pulled it back into the blood and the body of Jesus, and that's what we do on Sundays. So thank you for doing that. That was really, really meaningful. I hope that everybody had an enjoyable change of pace the last few days. I often find in my own life change of routine, sometimes a change of location just leads to some refreshment. And so I hope that that happened to you over the last few days. I ate more pie in the last 2 days than I have the entire calendar year. It was a lot of pie. Who ate pie? Raise your hand. Anybody? Good. That's what you should do this time of year. It's funny how the memories tied to embarrassment tend to stay with us. So when I was in third grade, I went up to my elementary school for some kind of a fall fun night. Everybody was doing activities, and you got cornhole and basketball and a cakewalk, all sorts of things, all of which I like. And I surprised my parents and myself for that matter, and I got in line for something I'd never do. It was the line for face painting. None of my friends were in this line, and I just stood there by myself waiting to get to the front of this line so someone could paint my face. Now, does anybody have any guess as to why, as a third grader, I would do something completely out of character? It's always about the girl, you know? Her name was Erin Smith. She was the cutest girl in the third grade, and I reasoned that if I just stood in line, she was about three people in front of me, if I just stood there, that she would notice me, and then somehow she would pay attention to me, maybe become my girlfriend. And so I stood there without my friends for the longest time, and I got up to the front of the line, and that's when I realized this is not face painting. This is makeup. It hadn't dawned on me. I was the only boy in the line. Didn't dawn on me. So I'm up at the front of the line, and now my heart is racing. And there is this volunteer mom, and she's just looking at me, and she doesn't know what to put on my face, and I don't know what to do. I'm panicking. And you know, at that age, you don't realize what we now know as adults, like normal things. So I didn't realize that I could just say, oh, I was in this line by mistake, I'm just going to go to the next game. I could have said that, but I didn't know I could say that. I thought I was locked in. I was like, well, I got to do something here. And so in my panic, the only thing I could come up with was this. As a kid, I was I'm a huge Michael Jordan fan. And so I just asked this volunteer mom, I said, can you just write the word Chicago Bulls in red lipstick on my forehead? And so she did. She wrote Chicago Bulls on my forehead, and Erin Smith never became my girlfriend. But I learned early on this principle. We all know this to be true. To be liked by those that you like, you feel like you have to do what they do. This is just a principle in life. It applies to everybody. If you want someone to like you, then you want to talk like they talk, or you dress like they dress. And we do things like this all the time. We do these things subconsciously. The things that you say, the things that you don't say, the things that you wear, so much of that comes from you want to be liked by the people that you like. And so we talk about certain celebrities and politicians and entertainers in certain ways because we want people to like us. And then we talk about other celebrities and entertainers in other ways because we want another group of people to like us. I mean, how many of you have ever been in a social setting? You don't have to raise your hand. Actually, no, I do want you to raise your hand on this. This is going to make us all feel better. How many of you at some point in your life have been in a social setting and someone's made a joke and you have no idea what it means, but you just laugh along with it because that's what you're supposed to do? Okay, we all know what that feels like. To be liked by the people you like, you feel like you have to do what they do. Now, sometimes this can be a benefit or a blessing even from a spiritual perspective. For example, I'm a big proponent of 1 Corinthians 9. This is where Paul says, I've become all things to all people. so that by all possible means I can save some. And that's a great way to think about life. So you will take on some of the opinions or some of the practices of certain groups of people to relate to them so that you can tell them about Jesus. Like, that's a really, really good thing. So it's not like this principle is always bad all the time. However, there's a dark side to it. Sometimes Christians so desperately want to be liked by other people that they end up becoming just like the world around them, and so there's really no witness there. In fact, there was an article written just a few years ago by a secular agnostic man named Ben Sixsmith, and it was very indicting towards Christians. He made an eye-opening point. Here's what he says. I'm not religious, so it's not my place to dictate to Christians what they should and should not believe. Still, if someone has a faith worth following, I feel that their beliefs should make me feel uncomfortable for not doing so. But if they share 90% of my lifestyle and values, then there's nothing especially inspiring about them. And this last line is just really thought-provoking. Instead of me, as this secular agnostic, wanting to become more like them, it looks very much as if they want to become more like me. Whew, that's a scathing critique of Christianity from someone outside the Christian faith. So Ben is a secular agnostic, and his experience of Christians in this, in his context, is that they're basically just like he is. They're not that different from modern secular humanist culture. So in other words, they want to be liked by mainstream culture, and so they're going to do all the things that they need to do to fit in. So their language, their sexual ethic, their treatment of their enemies, their relationship to money and success, pretty much the same as everybody else. And so he's saying, why would I want to follow your faith if your faith already looks like my life? And he's right. Why would any non-Christian be compelled by a Christian if the Christian looks exactly like the non-Christian? So, here's the question I'd like to sit with today for a few minutes. What would you have to do to be the kind of Christian that would make non-Christians do a double take? So Peter apparently thought that this was possible. So he famously said in 1 Peter 2, live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits us. So he's assuming that Christians would live their lives in a certain manner so that non-believers would look at them and do a double take. So it's possible to do this. Paul puts it very famously as well in Romans chapter 12 when he says this, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So two opening comments about this particular verse. First, in any era, there will be a worldly pattern at odds with a righteous life. So in the first century, it was a host of things. It was the unchecked power of Caesar and the Roman Empire. It was the unrestrained sexual practices of the culture at large, which harmed in many ways women and children more than others. It was the blind eye turned towards the vulnerable in that era. So they had this pattern of the world which was at odds with the life of Christ. And it's the same with our world today. Every era has this tension. So in our world today, there's a host of examples. Rampant individualism, which says that you should untether yourself from any group, tribe, or authority. You do you. Well, that's at odds with the way of Jesus. Or there's the obsession with winning. You should do everything in your power, or even outside your power, to get what you want. I've thought of that lately with all of these gambling schemes, with all these high profile people who already have a lot, but they want more and more and more. There's the culture of outrage, which is normal in our secular world, but is very much in tension with the way of Jesus. There's the commodification of sex, the denigration of the covenant of marriage. There's abortion. There's the worship of money. There's the idolatry of sports. All of these are antithetical to the way of Jesus. They make up our current pattern. So the first thought to realize or understand from Romans 12, verse 2, is simply that in every era, there's going to be a tension between the pattern of the world and the way of Jesus. But a second truth to remember is there's always a way to resist and transform. Because that's what Paul says, don't be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. There's always a route towards transformation. So I'd like to give you three ways to do that from this text. So first, look at verse 14. So Romans 12 is really interesting. Verses 1 and 2 are almost the thesis. And then the rest of the chapter is that this is what this looks like. Here's how you transform your mind so that you do not simply acquiesce to the pattern of the world. So one of the ways we do this, verse 14, Paul says, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Or he says this in verse 19, do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. So if we are to live the kind of lives that would make unbelievers do a double take, I would suggest three things. First is this, we speak differently. The pattern of our world today is to demonize the other side. It's to not give them the benefit of the doubt. It's to not treat them with dignity. It's to see the other side as an opinion, not as a person. But Paul is advocating for something much more radical. He's saying, you should bless the people that persecute you. Very similar to what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. Can you imagine the impact that would make on the world if you specifically chose to live your life that way? And if we collectively chose to live our lives just based on this one verse, bless those who persecute you. In other words, speak differently. A member told me this story 2 or 3 years ago. There was a woman at his work who wrote an article in a local publication about some hot topic issue of the day. And she sent this article on to her editor, her boss. And he read it and said, hey, this is a great article. You've got your facts right. And I completely agree with the overall thrust of your article. However, you're using extremely disparaging language towards certain groups of people. So I'd like you to rewrite it. Keep the facts. Keep the overall point that you're making. But take out the hateful rhetoric. And let's publish that article. Like, wow. Like that my respect for this person who made her make the changes went up really high. That's what Jesus would do. This is transformative living. You can still have your opinions, but you do so with, you speak with dignity. You bless those who persecute you. So the first thing we do is to speak differently. Here's another picture that Paul paints of not conforming to the pattern. Verse 10, he says this, honor one another above yourselves. Or in verse 13, he says, share with the Lord's people who are in need. So these practices were not in line with the pattern of that time. And they actually are not in line with the pattern of our time either. And so if we want to stand out in our culture today, a second thing we can do is we can treat differently. So first, we speak differently. Second, we treat differently. And what I mean by this is we treat people differently than our culture at large. I was reminded of what this looks like just a few weeks ago. One of my good friends, he's one of our newest staff members, Kendon Murrell, told me this really interesting story. So Kendon is our hymn worker, which stands for Helpers in Missions, and Third Culture Kids Minister, which stands for TCK, and he's been doing a great job the first few months in both of those areas. But he told me this story of something that happened to him in 2011. In 2011, Kendon was over in Japan teaching English at an elementary school, and an earthquake ravaged the area, and ensuing tsunami did more damage, and this nuclear reactor had a meltdown, which did even further damage. So he told me the story of what it was like. He was actually in the school when the earthquake happened, and so he quickly got the kids out of the building onto the blacktop, and he remembers standing on the blacktop, and he says that the blacktop itself was going in a motion of a wave on the ocean. It was just this surreal experience for him as the aftershocks of this earthquake came through. Now, in the subsequent days and weeks, people of Japan were trying to put their lives back together out of this devastation. And most people who were not from Japan left. They got on planes and they got out of there, but not Kenden. He stayed day after day after day, week after week, and then the weeks turned into months, and eventually he stayed so long just helping people, giving food to those who needed food, transportation to those who needed transportation, just being a source of stability to all these people whose lives were falling apart. And he stayed so long that people started to ask him, like, why are you here? Like, all the other people from other countries, they've left. What are you still doing here, and why are you helping us? And the only answer that Kenda could think to give was, well, I follow Jesus. I'm a Christian. This is just what we do. And so notice, he was treating people differently than most of the world at large at that time. And so therefore, people noticed it. Oh, that's different. Something's going on with you. Well, that's what you want to happen. That does make people do a double take. Huh, there's something different about a guy like Kenda. And so if we want to push back against the pattern of the world, the first thing we do is we speak differently. Say that with me, speak differently. The second thing we do is we treat differently. Say that with me, treat differently. The third thing we do, it also comes from Romans, but I want to read you two verses. They're not from Romans 12. This is more just the overall thrust of the letter. First verse I want to read you is from the very opening paragraph where Paul lays out where he's going with the letter. And he writes this, Jesus... This is a long paragraph about Jesus, but this one part's really important. Jesus, who through the Spirit of holiness was appointed the Son of God in power by the resurrection of the dead. So already early in the letter, he's pointing out that we believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And then in chapter 6, he says it very explicitly. He says, for if we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly also be united with him in a resurrection like his. Now, these statements, for those of us who are Christians, they're just so normal. We've been reading the passages like this and singing songs like this our whole lives, and so it's just normal. And yet, when Paul wrote these words many, many years ago, they were so at odds with the culture at large. Nobody said things like this. Nobody believed things like this. And so here's the third thing that we have to keep doing as Christians in order to push back against the pattern of the world. We have to believe differently. So Paul is saying here that following Jesus is not just about being good and doing nice things and being a good person. That's important. But Paul is actually saying in the book of Romans in general and through so much of his writings that following Jesus is about believing crazy things. Paul is saying, especially in Romans 6, in that one verse, he's making several audacious claims. One, he's saying, we believe that a dead man got out of the ground. He was dead. His heart had stopped. There was no brain function. There was no air in his lungs. And then a few days later, he came back to life. That is a supernatural, audacious, physics-defying, biology-defining belief. And then Paul's saying, not only do we believe that Jesus rose from the dead, we also think that everybody in Christ is going to do the same thing. He's basing all of his faith on this supernatural, metaphysical claim, and he's unapologetic about it. You see, Christianity is not Christianity without the belief in the miraculous. Second century author Tertullian puts it in this paradoxical way. He said, the resurrection is certain because it is impossible. In other words, the crazy belief stuff, it has to be here. It's what makes Christianity the way that it is. Now, all throughout history, there have been streams of thought that have pushed back against this, that have tried to say, well, we like Jesus and we like his teachings, but we really don't want to do any of the miraculous stuff. So, for example, the Gnostics in the second century, they thought that the incarnation and the resurrection of Jesus would be hard to believe for the pagan world. And so they just said, let's put them to the side and reinvent Jesus as a wise sage. Or you can fast forward to the Enlightenment, and those leaders thought that the Spirit and miracles and the resurrection of Jesus were simply too fantastical for the modern, sensible mind, and so they just ignored those passages. Thomas Jefferson famously cut those parts out of his Bible. And so the question is, how did those strains of Christianity fare? And historically, the answer is not well. To enjoy the fruits of Christianity without the roots of Christianity has not been sustainable. And so these strains of trying to push aside the audacious beliefs, they might be popular for a time, but they never carried the long-term impact or the cultural force that historic, orthodox, traditional, miraculous Christianity did. And so this exhortation from Romans 12:2 to not conform to the pattern of this world, one way of saying this is simply this: we must tether ourselves to the Spirit of God rather than the spirit of the age. We'll always be tempted to do that. You see, in every era, there's going to be trends and fads within Christianity to get with the times or to reinterpret this text or this doctrine in light of this modern person or event. And we simply have to be very discerning about these matters. William Engle put it really succinctly. This is not on the screen, but this is a really good quote. He said, whoever marries the spirit of the age, or of this age, will find himself a widower in the next. So rather than being whisked away by the popular tide of the day, it's important to remain passionate and focused upon the historic, peculiar, Newtonian physics-defying pillars of faith. We must believe in the resurrection, in the incarnation, in the virgin birth, in the existence of spiritual beings, in heaven, in the Holy Spirit. Like, all of this matters, and all of this belongs. And if we give up these things, then we're simply acquiescing to the false spirit of our age. So here's a recent example to illustrate why belief in the miraculous is really important. So Tom Holland is arguably the most well-known historian on earth right now. Now, Tom Holland is also an actor that plays Spider-Man, very famous as well. There are two Tom Hollands. This is the one that is a historian. He's written a lot of books. He has one of the most listened to podcasts in the world right now called The Rest is History. So he is analytical historian. Well, earlier in his life, he wrote a book in 2012 called The Shadow of the Sword. And in this book, he took all the rigors of historicity and he applied them to the world religion of Islam. And in that book, he actually uncovers that a lot of the historical claims about Muhammad or the Quran are not necessarily the most sustainable when it comes to modern scrutiny. And so he wrote this book, and then a lot of people reacted to it. And some of the people that reacted to it that didn't like it said, hey, you would never do that to your childhood faith, Christianity. Like, you would never take all the rigors of modern historicity and apply them to Christianity. And so he thought to himself, that's a good point. I guess I should do that if I'm going to be authentic as a historian and as an author. And so he did. He spent years studying Christianity just from this historical lens, and then he wrote this enormous book called Dominion about Christianity. And in Dominion, he says a lot of things. One, the just interesting side note, the manuscript claims and the evidence of all manuscripts with the New Testament especially are incredibly verifiable and incredibly strong comparatively to other world religions like Islam or others. So that's one of the things he talks about. But overall, the thesis of the book Dominion is actually this. It's that every modern impulse towards benevolence to the poor, or lifting up the vulnerable, or the sick, or loving children, like any of that, any instinct towards human rights in the whole world traces back to Jesus. All of it comes from the Jesus movement. And so there's no hospital, there's no educational system, there's nobody that ever wakes up and wants to go help someone who's down and out on their luck. Nobody who ever helps a child or a sick person that can't trace that impulse back to the Jesus movement. Like he's astonished because it didn't come from Rome. It doesn't come from secularism or from atheism. It actually all comes from Christianity. So it's this amazing book. That's his main thesis. Now, Tom Holland himself is kind of a Mark 9 person. So if you remember back at the beginning of this series, Believe in Me, I did a sermon on Mark 9, where this man famously says to Jesus, "I do believe, help me overcome my unbelief." And so Tom Holland would say there are moments where it all seems real and other moments it's hard to believe. Well, he talks about this story, which is so interesting to me, where he had this supernatural experience that he talks a lot about. So here's what happened. It was 2016, and he was filming this documentary about ISIS. And so he's in this city in northern Iraq that is basically been reduced to rubble by ISIS. They've taken over, they've killed a lot of people, but they've left. And so he wanders into the ruins of this church building. And just outside the church building, there are actually crosses where they've crucified Christians in the past, just a few months before he walked into this church. So he walks into this church, and there's rubble everywhere, and he's just picking up pieces of pews, and there's wood, just it's all a mess. And he picks up this shard of a painting of the angel Gabriel. And when he picks this up and he looks at it, he says in that moment, he had this overwhelming experience where all of it seemed true, like everything. He just had this incredible moment of full stop belief. And here's what he wrote about that particular incident. He said this: "It was a kind of sweet sense of intoxication that perhaps everything was weird and strange." And he means that in the best way. He goes on to say, "In the moment you accept that there are angels, then suddenly the world just seems richer and more interesting." He would go on later to comment on the churches that seem to be growing in the world they have a particular kind of belief. And so he said this: "The area of growth seems to be churches that take the supernatural, angels, and the signs from God seriously. I do not understand why anyone would be interested in a Christianity that is not taking these things seriously." And so what does all this mean? This simply means that you, at some point in your life, maybe right now, you are going to be tempted to acquiesce to our secular culture and give up your beliefs. You're going to feel this pull to maybe put aside your belief in the resurrection of Jesus, or your belief in the new heavens and the new earth, or your belief in miracles or angels or the Holy Spirit. But all I'm saying is that everything in the Christian faith is hinged on these crazy, extraordinary, miraculous claims. Like, you can't have the fruit of Christianity without the root, and the root is based on the miraculous. And so if we ever hope to turn heads and to cause the agnostic, atheist, unbelieving, secular world to do a double take on the way we live our lives, then it's going to come from three things. It's going to come because we're speaking differently, because we're treating others differently, and then because we're believing differently than the rest of the world. In fact, in 2 weeks, I'm going to start a series for our holiday season on angels. And I'm not going to talk about angels simply as these mythical beings of the past, but I'm going to talk about them as present realities present beings which do God's bidding and give him glory. In fact, just as a preview of that series, I'll share one thing about them as we close. So we're about to sing a song, the Jesus Way, which is in so many ways tied to the heart of this message. And while we sing this song, if you need prayers from one of our shepherds, they'll be in the back two atriums. If you'd like to come forward and put your faith in Jesus and in the resurrection and go to that Romans 6 passage where you're buried with him through baptism into death, so that just as Jesus is raised from the dead, you're raised from the dead. That happens at baptism. And if you'd like to get baptized this morning, I'll be down front to meet you. But before we sing this song, just to give you one small point about angels, when we catch glimpses of them in the Bible, they're all over the Bible, by the way, but when we get this opening into the heavenly realms, like Isaiah chapter 6 or Revelation chapter 4, Revelation chapter 5, the thing we see angels doing is they're worshiping. They're made to bring praise and glory and honor to the Lamb. And that's one of the things that we actually share in common with angels. We're made to do the same thing. We are made to worship. And so, would you please stand? Let's lift our voices together with the angels as we worship our God.